We're going to call the House Committee on Rules to order and open an informational meeting. Do we want to call roll?
No, I think we're okay with that.
Just some opening comments that I want to make. One of the real issues that I believe strongly that this committee needs to work on during this session is truly look at the Senate Bill 10 from last session and the ethics rules. And I believe that the people here and the people from last session truly want to encourage, support, and have accountability around our ethical decisions that we make as legislators and others. And when we pass bills at times, the unintended consequences or the lack of clarities can sometimes cause more problems than they help solve other problems. And today's little hearing is mostly to get, for all of us, a clear perspective of what happened with the bill that we passed, and can we start to identify some of those places where clarity is more important, because it will make everybody's jobs better. And I think one of our other representatives will make the comment that I absolutely agree with, and that is that all we can do is open up the system for people to view it, and then others will have to make decisions. But ethics cannot be legislated. It is how we act and how we treat each other. And I think others will make some of those same comments. And I appreciated it when Representative Berger was having that discussion with me and reminding me of some stuff that she had said last year. And I just wanted to make that. But I truly agree with that. And we, as we go through this, what we can do is make it possible for the public to understand and check and look and make their decisions. But truly it's how we treat each other and the other things that, that make and determine that the true behaviors that we have. So with that, and I guess the other thing I would say before we get started, I think that the people in Oregon who have been entrusted with watching us and others who have public office do the things that we do have been very, very clear about going after, and we have had members end up in prison and others because they have done things that were wrong, and we have people who take care and see that very seriously. And so we want to encourage people to make good decisions and make sure that the public feels comfortable, because it is our trust and the trust that they have in us that helps us do our jobs. So with that, unless anybody else wants to make any other opening statement, which they certainly can, Representative
Berger. Yeah, the one thing that, and I appreciate your comments, the one thing that also has to be kept in mind is that we are a participatory government. We depend on everybody being with an oar in the water, every citizen who has time to serve on a board or a commission or in some way go to a public meeting and participate. So while we have to have ethical standards that we expect, and we have to have some transparency in our elected and appointed officials, we also have to be very careful if we're making barriers to that participation by making the regulatory climate be one that people who would ordinarily volunteer say, whoa, wait, that's more than I signed up for. So there's two, it's like everything is a double-edged sword, and this is something we need constant vigilance on, in my opinion.
Okay. Thank you very much. And with that, I would call our first witness, and that would be Dexter Johnson, Legislative Counsel, and he's accompanied by... Are you coming up, John? It's up to Dexter.
Yeah, sure.
And last name?
Zendlick.
Zendlick, okay. Much easier than it appears. Yeah.
Silent J.
Mr. Chair, members, good afternoon. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Counsel, and with me is Deputy Legislative Counsel Gina Zendlick, who is the ethics lawyer at Legislative Council. What I'm going to do today, basically, is walk you through a report that I believe you all have in front of you, which was prepared in the summer of 2008, late spring and summer of 2008. Mm-hmm. And basically, it is a reaction to Well, as you all know, in 2007, there was substantial comprehensive ethics reform legislation. And that was rolled out after the end of session in early 2008. And as a result of that rollout, there was a lot of public confusion and concern about the direction of the 2007 ethics reforms. And so legislative leadership asked myself, Phil Schradl from the Attorney General's office, Kelly Skye, General Counsel for the Governor's Office, and Marjorie Taylor from the Department of Administrative Services to take a look at the 2007 legislation, the processes that went into that led up to that 2007 reform effort, and the rollout of that and the public's reaction to it, gather that information together, gather public comments together, and distill them into kind of a framework for you to look at and evaluate in this session. And this report really is the culmination of that effort. So with that, let me just begin by giving you a little bit of background into ethics law in the state of Oregon and where things were leading up to 2007. Basically, Oregon was one of the first states in the country to adopt any kind of ethics law in the 1970s. And that law saw significant attention on the part of the legislature and kind of a piecemeal effort pretty much every session from 1974-75 when it was first enacted onwards. And so by the early 2000s, what you had was a contradictory, piecemeal, confusing set of standards that you all had to apply as public officials and that the public had to work through. And that caused a lot of concern that folks who were subject to the ethics laws would unintentionally violate something or not be able to follow the laws or by mistake violate them. And so in 2004, the governor asked the Oregon Law Commission to take a look at comprehensive ethics reforms, and the Law Commission, which, as you know, is this kind of blue ribbon panel of attorneys and legal scholars, they took a multi-year look at this and developed some proposals for consideration in the 2007 legislation. At the time, it was not considered to be significant, but one of the proposals was for changes in the statement of economic interest, and their recommendations in that area were largely followed by the 2007 legislature. You can read their findings on that on page 3 of the report, but basically it wasn't something that there was a lot of attention paid to at the time. But they recommended some reforms to the statement of economic interest, including having it apply broadly to public officials throughout the state, as unlike the law that had been in place before the reforms. Let me start over again. Prior to 2007 reforms, the statement of economic interest was not applicable to public officials who resided in cities or counties that hadn't voted for the 1974 legislation. And so some cities and counties were subject to this, others weren't. The reason I bring this up now, the Law Commission recommended that it be uniformly, that folks be uniformly subject to this SEI reporting. and you adopted that in the 2007 legislation. And simply put, that change, more than any other, has been has triggered the substantial outcry that rollout of the 2007 reforms led to. In addition to that, there was a number of other recommendations that the Law Commission made concerning gift limitations and entertainment and those kinds of things, of which you adopted some but not others. And in 2007, you passed Senate Bill 10 and House Bill 2595 that substantially altered those limitations, that substantially changed the Government Ethics Commission processes for oversight over ethics rules and how one could get guidance from them, and a number of other changes that we'll get into. So that's kind of the background leading up through 2007 and your enactment of the 2007 reforms. Caused a lot of concern. Legislative leadership asked us to look into this. Our process was essentially we met with representatives from the Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities, Special Districts, Port of Portland, City of Portland, COSA, and other associations, gathered their comments. We met on two separate occasions with the Government Ethics Commission. Their administrator, Ron Burson, who's here today, and their counsel, Lynn Rosick from the Attorney General's office, and other staff from the Ethics Commission, gathered comments from them and what their experience was like in implementing this legislation. We solicited comments from all public officials who are required to file statements of economic interest, and from the public in general, and received approximately 300 and some comments from those folks. And we met with the Law Commission, Wendy Johnson from the Law Commission, and went through their process and what they looked at in developing proposals that you considered and in part adopted in 2007. And that all culminated, did a lot of fact-finding, distilled that information, and that culminated in this report. So with that, what I'd like to do is turn to what happened basically after you enacted Senate Bill 10 and House Bill 2595. The Government Ethics Commission, as you know, is a very small agency. It was smaller at the end of 2007 than it is now by half. There were essentially three employees. You authorized them to increase their staff by an additional three, 100% increase. They did so over a period of about 8 months, hiring an additional training trainer, investigator, and office staff person. Nevertheless, one of the huge challenges in the implementing the reform was basically the Ethics Commission had a mountain of work, a tidal wave of work heading to it, and it was there. A lot of this is a resource issue. They as soon as the reforms were enacted, they were called upon to do an enormous amount of training, to answer requests for a great deal of specific fact situations. Is this an ethics violation or isn't it? Go through a rulemaking process to implement the legislation. And at the same time, and I'm not sure what the reason was for this, they moved their office from the archive building to their current location in South Salem, all of which led to a lot of a vacuum of advice. And when there's a vacuum, there's a lot of confusion that results in a lot of misinformation. And that was the situation that developed over the 6 to 8 months following the passage of the 2007 legislation. The demands on the Ethics Commission for training opportunities and for written or oral advice to deal with specific situations, I believe, continues. Ron is, I think, going to be your next witness, and he can speak more directly to that. But one of the findings that we came up with was that there is a significant resource, staffing resource challenge that the Ethics Commission faced in the rollout, and we assume still faces. As I mentioned, the biggest single point of contention in this was what was a minor point in 2007, and that is the Statement of Economic Interest form and the related quarterly reporting form that SEI filers also have to file. The form is one which, to date, is something where public officials who are subject to it do not self-select. In other words, if all of you are subject to reporting this form, you can't go to the Ethics Commission website, fill it out, and send it to them. You can't print it and mail it to them. You have to wait for it to be mailed to you, and then you fill it out and mail it back to them. Because of this fact, and the fact that suddenly there was a lot more people that were subject to filing the form, and the fact that the commission was buried in other activities like rulemaking, training, and the like, for 2008, the first year that this new form was required to be filed by officials, the commission didn't actually get to it until pretty late in the day. They designed the form to include the new information in January and began developing the list of public officials to whom the form needed to be mailed. It took a lot longer than anticipated because there were so many new public officials that were required to fill out the form, and because there wasn't a way for public officials to file before they received it in the mail. And so the end result was that the form didn't get mailed until about 2 weeks before it was due. And for some folks, it was even later than that because they hadn't confirmed yet that they were public officials required to file the form. A lot of confusion over that, and a lot of anger, and a lot of misinformation, at least initially, about what the form was going to require. And this fueled a great deal of, amongst local public officials, particularly in those areas that hadn't been subject to this before, which are largely rural communities and counties in eastern and southern Oregon. It fueled a kind of wave of resignations and objections to the form. In fact, if you want to look at the numbers, that is, I believe, on page 8 of the report, second paragraph, there were 203 public officials who resigned and said that violence form. And there were, when this information was gathered, May 20, 2008, of the 5,500 required filers, there was approximately a little less than 20% that had not filed, and a number of those didn't file because they were objecting to the form. So a lot of unhappiness over it, and a lot of that was driven by a series of factors, but really the contents of the form, and there were certain things that in particular were many people found offensive about what was required to be reported. We found that the biggest single reason was the listing of relatives. The form requires a public official to list their relatives, including spouses, children, persons to whom you owe a support obligation, siblings, and parents and I'm not sure if it says grandparents or not, but a comprehensive list of relatives. Many public officials felt that was excessively intrusive into their personal privacy, in part because the relatives were not people who had consented to be public officials. They had not gone out and sought this, and suddenly they were going to be required to be listed on this form. Other objections had to do with the fact that a number of public officials had estranged relatives, folks they hadn't talked to in many years, and there were personal wounds and the like, and reporting, having to report this information dredged up all of this unpleasantness from the past that, in the view of many commenters, was not really the state's business in the first place. There was a great deal of concern about public safety and identity theft with regard to reporting relatives who, again, many commenters said this. The relatives didn't sign up for this. We did, but they didn't, and therefore we ought not to be required to report information about those folks. Many public officials, as you are aware, are subject to harassment from people who are angry, justified or not. A lot of commenters noted that this would simply broaden the scope of the people who are subject to this kind of harassing behavior, because they would just be additional targets for these people who act unreasonably. Many folks noted that because of the intrusive quality of this kind of report, many of these city and county positions are volunteer positions, hard to fill in the first place. And the having to be subject to this kind of a report with all the negative elements that these folks felt the report involved would make it harder to recruit volunteers for these positions. Finally, there was a great deal of concern about another aspect of the 2007 bill, that is the requirement that the SEI information by 2010 be reported on the Internet, or be posted on the Internet. The Statement of Economic Interest has always been a public record, but many comments noted the difference between a public record where somebody has to identify, I'm requesting this information, and the public record request itself is a public record, and the ability to anonymously go on the Internet and view this information, and felt there was a qualitative difference that heightened the security risks and risks of identity theft and that sort of thing. And so there was a great deal of objection to Internet access to this information. Finally, many commenters noted that the quality of filling out this report and the information that it asked for left them with a sense that there was a presumption of wrongdoing on their part and a lack of trust that the state failed to, didn't trust them. This was particularly true, a number of commenters noted that this was particularly true, kind of reflected a urban outlook, and it was being imposed on rural individuals, and they really felt this is a local thing, and here's Salem not trusting us, and we don't like that feeling. I said finally, but probably there are a couple of other items as well. A lot of concern that this was not right because it was overriding the will of the 1974 voters. And I'll explain that a little. I touched on it, but I want to make it clear. In 1974, public officials did have to file a form of the Government Ethics Commission, or its predecessor. But if you were from a city or county that didn't vote for the 1974 reform, you were exempt from that requirement. And in 2007, the legislature eliminated that distinction, and everyone was subject to it. A great deal of the frustration about the form came from those cities and counties that weren't subject to it to begin with. There's a couple of other minor things, but I think I probably touched on the form and the concerns about that, most of the major points on that. And as I said, even though that wasn't the subject, it was a minor subject of the 2007 legislation, it was by far the single biggest objection of the public to the 2007 reform.
Was that the form was also a part, though, with the judges? I mean, I read that in the comment, and that was really the form for the safety issues and others was their concern as well, correct?
That's correct. The judges in particular, and they have examples that they can point to, because of the nature of their work, they are dealing on a one-on-one basis with highly emotional issues and with folks that are going to be really severely impacted by their decisions, that public safety is a great concern to them. And, of course, they volunteer to be judges. They sign up for this or they run for the office, but their relatives don't. So they really had a great deal of concerns about that. And I believe there's ongoing litigation on the part of the judges asserting that, in fact, at least the relatives' information, if not all of the information on their SEIs, is under existing public records law, not subject to disclosure. I think Ron could probably update you on exactly where that litigation is, but I know it's ongoing. The concerns of the representatives of associations and the professional lobbyists was a bit different than the concerns of local public officials in particular. And so I'd like to turn to that for a little while. Those concerns were more on some of the substantive changes that you focused a lot on in 2007. One of those is the interaction, the different uses of the term legislative or administrative interest in the context of gifts. There's a lot of confusion about how that works. The term legislative or administrative interest is a defined term, and it, if you read the text of that, it is clearly directed at an individual. However, if you look at its application in terms of the restriction on gifts, that appears to be directed more at the entity at which the public official is serves in the capacity of a public official. So there's a lack of lining up of the term as it is used in the most crucial ways as a definition and in its the way it's applied in the gift limitation. A lot of concern about that. A lot of concern about really the scope of the term legislative or administrative interest. Does it apply to non-decision-making public officials or public employees, or should it be limited really to public officials who have decision-making authority? That's also true with the definition of public official. It's very, very broadly defined, and a number of folks questioned whether it's appropriate for mid-level and low-level public employees to consider them public officials or not. There was a feeling among public officials, in addition to the challenges that these limitations, as well as the SEI, pose in terms of recruitment, that the gift limitation and similar limitations hamper a public official's ability to work with other, say, nonprofit entities in that have shared missions and shared goals. Frequently, a public entity and a nonprofit entity want to achieve the same thing, and they're working together in a coordinated fashion. And the feeling among many folks that submitted comments was that these ethics rules, particularly as applies to gifts and the like, hampered that shared mission and working in a coordinated fashion to achieve a shared goal. A lot of concern about just the practical logistics of how you track, well, did I, have I given $50 worth of gifts to this individual over this year on an organizational level? Just a lot of practical logistic concerns about how to implement this. Many comments reflected a concern in this area, in addition to the SEI area, that the ethics laws were too intrusive into one's personal life, and that it really interfered with how one conducted personal relations in a way that was never really intended. The classic examples given were things like personal relationships between two public officials, even within the same public entity, and how that interacts with the gift limitation, and really some very you could take it to extremes, and a number of people did, about, well, does this mean my son can't give a birthday present, my 8-year-old can't give a birthday present to his 8-year-old friend because we work together, that sort of thing. I mean, probably not what was intended, but a lot of concern about, does this, in fact, subject me as a public official to violating the ethics rules because of this unrelated personal activity. I've already noted, but I'll note it again here, that a lot of concern was raised about the gift limitations and the way they're applied, ultimately serving to make it difficult to recruit folks to be public officials, particularly if they are volunteer positions. That kind of summarizes the basics of the comments we were given as a group. We also were asked to, and did do so, to not make recommendations, but select for you out of the universe of choices that you could make in ethics reform, some, I'll call them stars, that you may wish to consider. And you'll see them beginning on page 12 for the remainder of the report, and I will just touch upon them briefly. The first and leading cause of concern amongst all of the people that submitted comments was the listing of relatives on the SEI. So you, one choice would be to revisit that requirement, and there are a number of ways you could change it, whether it's deleting it entirely or making it expressly exempt from public disclosure, or perhaps limiting it to its application to only certain higher-level public officials. Posting of the SEI on the Internet, that's another issue that many folks raised, that you could take a look at whether you wanted to go ahead with that. And again, there are a number of options about how you actually could change that requirement from having only certain SEI filers have that be on there, limiting the amount of information that's available on the Internet, to eliminating the requirement entirely. Disclosure of real property and other kind of business interests which are required on the SEI, the number of folks who were also in business were concerned that they were at that disclosing this information would put them at a competitive disadvantage to their business competitors. That too could be something you could either choose to not be publicly available, have it be information that the Ethics Commission would have, but not have it be fully disclosable, or make some modification to that. The sources of income issue, that is a requirement on the SEI that you list the top five sources of income. A number of folks were concerned that this put them in it seemed to be arbitrary, because they could be five, they could be four really very minor sources of income in the case of some individuals, or income source number six for another individual could in fact be very significant. So there was a sense of arbitrariness there. You could take a look at whether you want to continue that requirement. The other issue on, and I only touched upon this, the SEI, in addition to that, public officials who are required to report an SEI are also required to report quarterly reports, as you know. Many commenters said, well, most of the time I don't have anything to report on those. So perhaps a change could be to only require reporting a quarterly report if there is some new information to, in fact, report on it. In other areas, I think I've touched a lot on these, but you could take a look in the gift limitation at how the definition of legislative and administrative interest, how that lines up with the limitation itself. As you know, doesn't line up exactly right now. You may want to think about getting that to be more consistent between those two uses. Definition of public official is another area where you could take a look at perhaps limiting that to officials who have decision-making authority. Finally, two recommendations you could consider that are not actually statutory changes. One would be increasing resources for the Government Ethics Commission. As I noted, the Ethics Commission continues to face considerable demands in training and answering questions. They still have rules. There are areas of the ethics law where there are not administrative rules, and so they still have additional rulemaking they need to do. Those could be addressed by additional staff resources. Finally, the final element of the report is, as I've noted, the Ethics Commission is a small agency. A number of small agencies find themselves in a situation where 10, 15 years go by and they're kind of doing their routine stuff, and suddenly there's a legislative change and they have a significant amount of things to do, And a number of people who submitted comments felt that a larger agency could be tasked with the role of helping these small agencies to undertake some of these big changes, like public relations support, like technical assistance in rulemaking, things like that. So, as I said, these are not recommendations. No one on the review panel is authorized to make recommendations. These are selections based on the comments that we received of areas you could consider, and it's kind of selected stars out of a whole universe. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Representative Gerard.
You had me just sold on everything you until the last statement. I'm wondering how many people in your task force that you looked wanted to expand the Government Ethics Commission?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. Of the members of the review team, none of us have an opinion. So we are reporting comments from. I will say that among professional lobbyists, there is recognition that they need further guidance.
They always do. So, but thank you very much. I appreciate your response.
Other questions? Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 13, there was a comment that jumped out at me. It says, many local government officials believe ethics violations to be a problem only at the state level. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about that. In my experience, people that come to state government live in local communities and are members of those committees. Is there a sense that there are never ethics problems
Communities? Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, there was a lot of comments to that effect that I would say fed into the rural versus urban Salem, you shouldn't be sticking your nose in our tent kind of. That was the feeling. The statistics, and I think Ron will be able to tell you more about that, but the statistics actually are just the opposite. Most ethics violations, in fact, about 75% to 80%, occur at the local level, and only about 20% at the state level.
Thank you.
Other questions? Seeing none, I want to thank you very much, and I thank you for the report. I think it is a great starting place, and we have a question right here. Representative Jensen?
A couple of pages of them. If we've got
yeah, that, please.
We've got an hour and a half to cover.
Yep.
Okay, now, seriously, a point of curiosity, I noted when you were talking about some of the people who were involved, that COSA was a group that was mentioned as being involved. And I am curious that why... And maybe you're not in a position to answer this. Maybe no one on this committee is. Why public school officials, school board members, members of the budget committees, various and sundry citing committees, et cetera, as far as schools are concerned, are exempt from reporting on the ethics?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, that's an excellent question, and it is one that many folks who submitted comments raised. It's unknown. There's a list in the statutes about who has to file statements of economic interest and who doesn't. And in the school area, off the top of my head, school board members do not, and they were an example of, well, why does someone who's represents, say, Portland Public Schools not have to file this, and someone from the mayor of a city of 500 people does? So there's many folks raised the comment that there's a lack of consistency about who's required to file and who isn't.
Well, if I
please
may follow up on it, it just seems to me that whoever's on that list comes about because of the legislation that was written whenever, wherever that happened to be. And groups were, this particular group or category was admitted for some reason, and I have some question about the ethics of omitting that particular group, having spent a lifetime in education, realizing that there's as much room for receiving gifts that could influence the purchasing contracts on the part of people in education, as there might be some of the other things. Follow-up or other questions,
yes.
Philip,
please,
if I may. Curious about the issue about those individuals. You mentioned something about judges, but about those individuals who are otherwise exempt from reporting, and I'm speaking of people in corrections or in law enforcement, and of reporting, if you wish, family members, which, as I understand the interpretation of this statute, these people, that particular group of people that had other protections as far as disclosure of their private information, those other protections were overridden by the Ethics Commission statute. And I have a number of examples of this that took place in my district. I happen to have a district that has two state prisons, several of the people who worked in those state prisons fell in into this category, and were some of the apparently 203 people who resigned on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, maybe a couple of points of clarification. There is the public officials are subject to the ethics laws, and they are just quite broadly defined, basically any public employee subject to the ethics laws in general, including the gift limitation. Only a select, much smaller universe is subject to the statement of economic interest reporting requirements and the quarterly reporting requirements. I think what you're describing is situations where folks who are employed as correctional officers serve as volunteers in cities or counties or planning commissions or that sort of thing, and as a result of their volunteer work are subject to the SEI. And there isn't you're right, there isn't an override. Once you are a public official who's listed on a legislatively generated list of officials who must file a statement of economic interest, there isn't a public security or public safety override of that.
Yeah, and I'm sorry if I didn't phrase the question clearly enough, but you have interpreted it regarding that correctly. And the individual who is a member of the State Corrections Department force, who then takes a job as a position as being on the planning commission for one of the roaring metropolitan communities of Eastern Oregon of some 135 souls, now is subject to the SEI sort of thing. Is that one of the areas that is a possible look at as we proceed to? I was also curious,
yes.
You said there were 203 people who resigned or that you know of or something who resigned or didn't That doesn't include probably the people who may have filled out or finished out their term or may have refused to sign up again for, you know.
Yeah.
So what the numbers might be or maybe... But you talked about these, and you said you made it, if I understood correctly, and by implication, not a direct statement, some difference in relationship to those who were paid individuals who were subject to the reporting and those who were volunteer individuals. And I'm curious, out of the 203 that you have documentation on who resigned, how many were paid individuals and how many of those were volunteer? Do we have that information or data?
Mr. Chair, Representative Roland, or Representative Jensen, I don't. The Ethics Commission would have that information, I think, and Ron will be coming after me.
Okay.
They may not have it available to them right now, however. The data on who resigned and who didn't is as of May 20th, 2008, so that's probably changed since then.
But this is a footnote on this, perhaps I have one of the most paranoid communities in the entire state of Oregon. But there was a substantial amount of discussion about these issues there, and none of the people that, and I cannot profess I have 100% of the folks that I talked to, but none of them were paid employees. They were all volunteer positions. And I heard in my local community no comments from what would have been paid employees of the state being required to file the SEI report. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Welcome.
And now we will call Ron Burson, Oregon Government Ethics Commission.
Good afternoon. Thank you, everyone, for giving me this opportunity to come before you. My name is Ron Burson. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. I had a chance to write down a few items I'd like to talk about before we get to the report that I think you have a copy of on what I had heard from the testimony of Mr. Johnson, just so we can clear up a couple of points. We talked about the number of SEI filers. The actual number for the agency prior to this legislation was about 4,200, and that rose to about 5,500 people that were required to file statements of economic interest. The best estimate we have for public officials is it was about 200,000 in the state of Oregon. Sorry, I've got to put my glasses on. It was talked about, and I talked about it in the report, too, about the agency moving. I just want to point out, and I'm not sure where Mr. Johnson got this information, but we were not in the archives building. We're actually in one of the homes across the street from the archives building, in the upstairs of that home. And the reason the agency had to move was with the increase in staff, we just simply would not fit anybody else in there. We had the three staff in there. We were sharing a restroom. We were pretty connected.
I did visit, and I it was too small for the three of you, actually, and the papers you were trying to keep track of.
That's the reason that the agency moved, And with, of course, moving to any location, there was some construction that was required, and so the agency wasn't able to move until September 1st. I want to talk real briefly about the purpose of the Statement of Economic Interest. We've talked about the problems with the statement, but I guess we all have to ask the question, why is it there? And why it hasn't been there for, you know, 30-plus years? And the purpose of the Statement of Economic Interest is to list down areas that you as a public official may run into a conflict of interest. And the main purpose of it, that's why we look at sources of income and real property. And when we talk about problems that happen in local communities versus the state of Oregon or larger communities, the statement is actually not for the state of Oregon. In fact, the legislation created the quarterly report, which is really the audible report that the state of Oregon would use on a public official. The Statement of Economic Interest is really for the citizens of the local communities to contact the agency, ask for that report, to see what their local officials are making decisions that could benefit themselves, either through their jobs, their sources of income, or the properties that they own. So that's the purpose of the report. And so anyway, I just wanted to bring up those couple of points before I got going here. I won't go over the history. I think Mr. Johnson's done an excellent job of talking about the history of the commission, when it came about, and the reasons for the commission. Some of the revisions that Senate Bill 10 included in that last legislation was it reduced the gifts from $100 down to $50, eliminated exceptions for gifts, and replacing those exceptions with more narrow exceptions. So you used to be able to travel in your official capacity. Now there's a couple of instances where you can travel, and they're very narrow. It also eliminated the exception for the consumption of food and beverage in the presence of the provider. So now the $100 down to $50, but you also have to count the food and beverage. And so, as you can imagine, that's probably the most popular gift given to public officials throughout the state. We all seem to be offered food, as I was today, and beverage, you know, as being public officials. And now that actually becomes part of the gift limitation. And so, again, I'm talking about the challenges that the agency has seen over the last year and a half or so. The other big challenge that happened in this legislation is this frequency and the information of the reporting that's required at the agency. So I also want to point out there some of the separation between Senate Bill 10 and House Bill 2595, and I tried to point that out in the report, what Senate Bill 10 did and what House Bill 2595 did. We seem to kind of put all this legislation on Senate Bill 10, but House Bill 2595 kind of got in to the nuts and bolts of what the agency did, and that included these reports, the frequency of these reports, and the information on the reports. And so I've listed that out for folks here. So that's really the history. So now I'll talk a little bit about the challenges. The first big challenge the agency came across, Mr. Johnson had talked about, is training. Now, we were still an agency of three people, and we were in the middle, of trying to move the agency. At the same time, we were inundated with a lot of requests for training from everywhere from folks in your position to local jurisdictions. And we didn't have the trainer at that time, and so we took that on, and we tried to perform that as best we could. We performed over 30 trainings around the state, and we also tried to keep our website up to date. But as you know, that was a big challenge for us. And most of that training was around the actual changes to the law. And the problem is that a lot of folks, until this legislation passed, really didn't have a lot of information on the law beforehand. And that's another issue. Just talking about that, legislative administrative interest, like Mr. Johnson talked about, is a large point for us. I mean, it's a swinging point on whether you can accept gifts or not, because if there is not a legislative or administrative interest, you can accept gifts in a limited amount. If there is, you're restricted. So, but the definition of legislative and administrative interest did not change in this legislation. It's just that there became a lot of light on that because people were saying, do I have that interest? So can I accept that? And so the agency was, you know, hadn't received those kind of inquiries in the past, and so the training tried to get around that. But it's a complex issue, and so it was difficult for us to meet those needs that the public officials really needed at that time. The agency really wasn't able to hire the trainer position until, I believe it was towards the end of January, and there were a lot of budgetary reasons for that delay. Like I say, I talked about the move and getting the other folks on, but I also want to point out that the trainer position was not funded for the full biennium. I believe the funding started in October for that position. Now, since the trainer has come on, we have actually done a lot more with our website. We've trained over 4,000 public officials in person, and that really doesn't even count all of the trainings that we have where we are broadcast around to other areas. The associations have worked very well with us in providing these opportunities that we can sit in one place and talk throughout the state. They've had great capabilities over here at the local government office, and we appreciate that. We're also using their newsletter each and every month to talk about issues that come before us that we see as a lot of questions, and we can get that information to a lot of people through their newsletters with the Association of Oregon Counties and the League of Cities. So we are working with those organizations to try to get the training out. Now the agency is also recognized I'll get into this a little bit more, too, the need for additional resources in training. And so in our 2009-11 budget, we have asked for additional positions to try to meet this increase in training needs, because there are going to be changes that happen in this session and probably in subsequent sessions. And so we really need to keep on top of that so people do have that chance of adhering to the law, because I still haven't met anybody that's called our office and says, I want to break this law. We all want to adhere to the law, so we want to give them the best chance of being able to do that. Okay.
You didn't get my voicemail?
Yeah, I did. I just didn't want to bring it up. The statement of economic interest was also a large challenge. As everybody knows, we asked for relatives and members of household. Now, Mr. Johnson didn't talk about members of household, but my experience from the agency is we have gotten just as many complaints on listing the members of household as we have on listing the relatives. Now, in other questions on the SEI, such as sources of income, many times a member or two of the household is listed through that process already, because as in my case, for my own statement of economic interest, my wife's salary is one of the five most significant sources of income. So I list my spouse. I don't have any children, so I don't have to list those as sources of income. So.
Did you just ask for a raise?
No, I did not, sir. No, I would not do that in this environment. I think Mr. Johnson actually summed it up pretty well. What we created here was we created a perfect storm. We added 99 cities and 6 counties that hadn't filed in the past. And by the way, there were a few cities that weren't around in 1975 when this vote came, or 74 that this vote came about. The city that I live in Kaiser, was created, I believe, in 82 or 83. And so when they were created, they were given the choice of not participating. And so the city that I live in Kaiser chose not to participate at that time. But these 99 cities and 6 counties were brought into the mix. And I don't remember a lot of testimony during the process from these groups saying, I object to being part of this process. So I think it was a bit of a surprise for them. The other thing that happened was this names of relatives and members of household. This upset a lot of people. And I don't want to go into all the comments, but I would be willing to bet that Mr. Johnson's comments that the Ethics Review team had put together, those are in books, and you're welcome to read them. And I'm sure the substantial portion of those is around this obtrusion of relatives and members of household. The other thing is the increase in reporting by adding the quarterly reports. You know, so these three things came together, created this storm of which, you know, in hindsight we could see it, but in foresight, I don't believe that we did see that coming about. And so it surprised all of us. Now,
Some of us saw it.
It surprised me. I'll just speak for myself. It surprised my agency. I want to talk about in the SEIs and the process the agency takes part in. Right now, we are currently working on the statements of economic interest. We contact people in each one of these jurisdictions to update the list of people that are required to file this. And again, it's a statutory requirement that, I mean, they list the actual people that have to file. They give us the names. Once we get those names, we mail the forms out to the people so you get your individual statement of economic interest. In 2008, we started that process again in January 15th. There was quite a bit of pushback by these 99 cities and 6 counties. They really didn't want to provide those names of folks, and so we struggled a bit to get those in. In a normal year, the agency would send out the SEIs to folks on March 15th. In 2008, those were sent out on April 1st, and so we were 2 weeks behind on this, but I just want to point out that the staff worked very hard, but it was difficult for us to get those names, to get the forms printed. I also have a challenge for all of us in this session is that, like I said, we have the process has started. We are asking the contacts for the names. I need to order forms by mid-February. I need to mail them out by mid-March. And so there is a bill that is out here to fix this problem, but without that fix, I'm required to send out a form that's going to have relatives and members of household, and it's going to light up the world again. So, just to point that out.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I just wanted to put on the record. I've heard from people in my community and surrounding communities the concerns about listing their relatives and members of household on the form. What I don't understand is the form does not ask for social security numbers, phone numbers, what address people live at. And of all of the concerns that are out there, I have a hard time being sympathetic to not wanting to name the people to whom you are related. I don't see why this is a problem. It doesn't put people at risk of harassment because it could be any Mindy Johnson. You don't even state what town these individuals live in. I just wanted to put that on the record. It frustrates me to continue to hear that concern because I cannot begin to fathom why anyone should be able to hide their relatives when they're serving the public or why they would want to if there's not an issue.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Clearly, Representative Gelser's relatives aren't my relatives. I'm hiding a lot of mine. The question, if I could just interject here, is not whether your relatives or my relatives are a problem. It's what's the purpose of the list? Who does it serve? And as far as I can see, I haven't found anybody yet.
And
Representative Gelser.
Thank you. And this was a part of the bill that I did hear concerns about this when we heard the bill in 2007. I believe the purpose of that list goes to conflict of interest, and I think that it is particularly important in smaller communities in the state where you have planning commission members and city councilors and county commissioners who are making decisions about contracts and goods and other things that are happening at a local level. And I think that you should know if your city councilor is voting to give a contract to his brother or his brother-in-law. I think that is an appropriate level of transparency for the government to have. I believe that was the purpose. We declare a conflict of interest when we stand up on the floor. If we have a conflict of interest for a relative with a financial interest that comes into.
We're going to take a lot of time to have conversations about these different issues, and I think there are some differing things. And I will just take one moment to say, if my last name was Johnson or something, I probably wouldn't be as affected. There's only one Roblin family that we've found in this country. So when I list my brothers and they want to go find them, that's the ones they find. So each person is a different thing. And if I was a police officer or another, I think there's another issue when you list those people and if they're in the same community. And to your question, most of the people in those small communities, at least in the ones that I'm at, when a person is getting a contract, they know that person's the brother. I mean, it's not an issue. They don't have to go look at the SAI form to find that. And I know that's not true in some of the bigger places. But I think that's part of the issue that we're having on this thing. There is a difference between where you exist, where you are, and how these things come into being. I didn't have any problem with it, but I recognized when I was talking to some of my local officials how they felt as it was intrusive. And the estranged relative that... and so on. So I think it's one that we have to have a conversation about, and we will continue to have that conversation, but today's not the place to do it. And yes, Representative Nolan.
Switching gears, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. I know, Mr. Burson, you weren't personally there, but do you know whether the Commission has any records about how the initial bill was received by the mandatory reporters? Did we have blowback? Did we have people say, this is an invasion of my privacy, I'm going to resign my position rather than do this? What I'm trying to get at is this reaction that we've received, which is real and something we need to pay attention to, but is it wholly out of proportion? Or is it, gosh, this is new and it's not what I thought I'd signed up for, so I'm a little cranky? I'm trying to give us a way of kind of weighing this reaction against the initial reaction in 74.
Chair Roblin, Representative Nolan, I don't have that information, but I can certainly look for that information and try to get some history for you if you'd like to have that.
Okay.
Talk about when the original 1974 bill passed.
Yeah, I'm betting, Mr. Chair, that there were people who were among the original people who were required to report this, who said, this is an invasion of my privacy, it's impugning my motives, I'm insulted, in much the same way that some people who are now newly affected.
Because I have great perspective on this, okay? I got a phone call one day from a guy who used to be on the board, or still is, I think, on the board of Chemeketa Community College, lawyer, law teacher, some guy that I had a lot of faith in. And he said, I'm working with the Law Commission on ethics reform. Would you be interested in being on the work group? And I said, yes, thanks for asking. And I think he was kind of blown away because it came out of nowhere. And the reason I said yes was, since my husband became an administrator at a community college level, every year he comes home with this form called the SEI, hands it to me and says, I know nothing about our finances. Here, fill out this form. I hated it. I hated it from the moment I saw it. It was an intrusion on my business. It served no useful purpose. If you want to know the reaction of people, that was my reaction. That's why I got involved on the Law Commission ethics reform thing. That form and that form only. Now, you can't tell me I'm not the only one in, you know. Now, who was that person that gave me a call? He's sitting right next to me. Okay? We are still at it, Jerry and I. Okay? And I would also like to point out that I was on the Ethics Commission, the work group that worked on this. We had two big interim vettings, and we had at least two session vettings on the Law Commission thing, where the Law Commission came in and explained what they were doing, and we made some mistakes on that, I'll guarantee you. I don't know what happened in the Senate, but this whole piece of legislation was done first in the Senate, and then it came over at the House at the very end, and to my knowledge, we didn't have more than a half an hour of public testimony on this. Now, that was our mistake, and it was a big one, because all those people who were affected never got the warning and the chance to come in and talk about it that I could see. And that is our problem, and that's why I'm here to fix it. Thanks for asking.
Thank you all.
Okay. Another issue I'd like to point out on the statement of economic interest, again, challenges from an agency. And by the way, when I say challenges, I don't always mean negative.
Right.
I mean, I hope I'm not giving a negative connotation. And if I actually gave the indication that I was advocating one way or the other, I'm just here for informational purposes. The agency prior to that, I told you, processed approximately 4,000, about 4,200 statements of economic interest. With the increase in the number of cities and counties, and the addition of the quarter reports, that number jumped to about 30,000. And so that's a significant increase,
okay,
again, for a small agency of, when they're fully funded, of six. So the actual emergency board granted the agency an additional administrative position recognizing this problem in the interim that is limited duration basis to process these reports and move forward to audit these reports, two of the quarterly reports, and that is in our budget for this next time to make that permanent. The other thing I wanted to point out on the statement of economic interest, we've already talked about the relatives and the members of household. It was talked a little bit about by Mr. Johnson, is the presiding judges of Marion, Deschutes, Lane, Mount Here, and Harney. I say those together because there's one judge that oversees Mount Here and Harney, and Clackamas counties have issued, they were able to issue a general order to the agency, restricting the agency not allowing the agency to disclose their statements of economic interest. Now, judges have the ability to write a general order, which most public officials do not. In that general order, they made it pretty clear that myself, as the custodian of the records, if I disclosed their information, that they would hold me in contempt of court. And so that is why we're going to an independent judge to find out, are they able to restrict their information, as other public officials do not have that ability. And that is still being briefed back and forth. But I just wanted to point out that this has been a challenge for the agency because to date there's been over $50,000 of AG expense on this one issue. And so that's a large portion of our Attorney General budget for the biennium. Now, Mr. Johnson talked a little bit about staff advice. I just want to put that in perspective. House Bill 2595 did a brilliant thing. See, nobody said brilliant thing in any of this ethics legislation, but did a brilliant thing in that they created a third level of advice. There's always been a formal commission advisory opinion. There's always been a staff opinion that comes from myself. They created this level called staff advice. They recognize that people are going to need a quick answer. There are time frames around the other two more formal advisory, both staff and advisory opinions. But the staff advice was a chance for somebody to contact their agency and get an answer quickly back, and so that they could rely on for their event. They didn't give complete safe harbor underneath this, but the agency had to consider that they gave that advice before they pursued any kind of violation. And I have said from the beginning of this implementation that this agency will not pursue anybody that they told they could do something for a violation. We would simply tell them that we're wrong and try to give them correct advice. But this advice we issue this advice back in writing, usually through email, so you have a record.
Right.
To date, we have written over 600 items of staff advice. That actually equates to about 1.5 FTE for the agency. Again, an agency that has 7 FTE, that's a major portion of this. And so when we talk about that we increase the number of investigators by one and a trainer by one, I actually ended up using 1.5 of those two positions just for this one issue. And so it's a major requirement for us to do. It's a lot of obligation. But as I've put in this report, it's important that we do that because that is where, you know, the rubber meets the road. This is where we're actually telling an individual what, you know, giving them advice on what they can and can't do so that they have some assurances that they are going in the right direction. Again, we need to respond to people that are asking us for advice. So I just want to, it's also increased some of our Attorney General costs, because many of these questions we really need to vet out with our AAG to make sure that we are actually giving the correct advice. Moving forward, underneath the lobby reporting, this is another area that was brilliant. Lobby reporting before these changes in 2007 was hit and miss at best. You had, in years of legislative sessions, lobbyists reported three times a year. Entities that hired them reported once. In off years, lobbyists reported twice a year, and entities reported once. Now everybody reports quarterly. And what the agency has found is that we have found the ability to actually look at those reports and make sure that they match up. And there has been several instances where lobbyists have come before the commission recently to fall on the sword, and because we have received reports into the agency from a client saying that I paid X number of dollars for lobbying, but we never got a report that from the lobbyist saying the same thing. And so I think that the lobby industry has kind of shored up some of their practices where they might have been a little bit loose before because reporting wasn't at the same time. And so by having it at the same time, it actually gives the agency a reasonable chance of performing the audit function that's required by statute. So we have really appreciated this. And I can go back to talk about that the number of reports have, of course, increased because instead of doing it, you know, once a year, we do it four times a year. Instead of doing it three, we do it four. But that's actually a small price to pay just to have that accuracy audits that are out there. Another challenge that we found is time frames. I talked about advisory opinions and staff opinions. House Bill 2595 put a time frame on the agency. The agency has always recognized the importance of getting advice back as quickly as possible. The challenge comes in that some of these advisory opinions are very challenging for the agency to complete. We actually had an instance where 39 requests came in at the same time. Well, again, with a staff as small as at the agency, we would have impossible time of actually completing that within the statutory time frames. So the solution that I came about with, or the agency came about with, was to break down those 39 questions into three major categories, and then we issued those three opinions, and for the responder, we actually referenced inside the opinion where we were answering each one of the questions. But we are very susceptible to being overloaded and not being able to meet the statutory deadlines. The reason I talk, especially around advisory opinions, that those create that safe harbor because the commissioners actually vote on that. Now, if I work an advisory opinion, I go to the commission and they disagree with that opinion, and so they say, go back and work on that. I am allowed one extension of 60 days, but if the next time, if I'm still off and they still don't want to vote for it, the commission actually has to say, no, we're not going to issue this opinion. And the reason why, we have to have a reason why. So the reason why is we couldn't meet the 60 days or we couldn't agree on it. So as an administrator, it makes me nervous that there's a statutory deadline that's out there. We're meeting that deadline, but we have been challenged, like I say, especially with this one request to meet that deadline. We had to get very creative to do that. Electronic reporting project. Mr. Johnson talked a little bit about electronic reporting. I want to separate electronic reporting out into two categories here. I talked about 30,000 statement of economic interest in QPOD, quarterly reports coming in to the agency, and 8,000 lobbyist reports coming in. Those all come in by paper, come in by mail and paper. And in this day and age, we should be doing this electronically. And the agency has been working on an electronic reporting system that the statute requires us to have up and running by January 1st of 2010. Now, I understand that there's a lot of concern about Internet access to the information that is reported, But I would like to separate those two categories out. I mean, I think we need to talk about getting the agency into this electronic phase. So instead of spending my resource in simply opening mail and sorting that mail and getting that mail filed into a file cabinet so somebody can request that document, I can spend my time or my resource in making sure that their information is correct, that this information is accurate. And right now we're not doing that because we're just inundated with paperwork. And I think that's one thing that the ethics reform team actually saw. They came out during this time. And, I mean, we literally get, you know, cartons of mail that come in because everybody likes to file on the last date that is due. But, you know, it's a real challenge for us. So even though we may look at the Internet access in a negative fashion, we may want to talk about that. If we could talk about this kind of separately and let us go forward. We were right to a request for purchase here. We're ready to hire a contractor to build this project. Let's build the system, and then let's talk about how we're going to allow people to access that information. It can still be accessed electronically, but we could require an electronic public records request so that there is a public record on who actually requested the information, like Mr. Johnson had talked about. But I would just like to, but that project has been a challenge for us. I mean, this is a project that's $700,000 for an agency that has about $1.1 million budget. So, you know, we don't have the ability to hire an extra project manager to come in. And so myself and my staff have had to take this on. And we're right on time. Everything's ready to go. But the funding, of course, is at the emergency board, which that will go back into the pot for this quarter. But we will be asking to have that money come forward so that we can have the contractor build that. The last thing that I'll do here is investigations. I simply wanted to point out to the committee that the number of investigations since 2005 has increased by 89%. The complaints have risen from 73 complaints being received up to 138 complaints in the last year. Now, we can debate all we want on why that's happening, but mostly it's probably because of an increased awareness about just this type of thing. I mean, we have taken on this challenge of looking at the ethics laws, and we as an agency have taken on the challenge of training the public officials and training the public on what a public official is required to do. And so those have increased. Now, the legislature granted me another position I talked earlier about, but I'm ending up spending 1.5 positions to answer the advice. So the investigators that I have at the office are still challenged to meet these statutory deadlines for the investigation process. So, and that's all I had. If anybody has any questions.
Representative Edwards.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Ron, has the change in the gift rules created confusion even among your staff? And the reason I ask is that I have been told anecdotally by either other members of the legislature or staff in this building that if I want a reliable opinion, not necessarily to ask just anybody at the Ethics Commission, but to ask you personally. And I have before, and I appreciate the advice that you've given to me, because I think, you know, I speak for all of us that we just want to be ethical and we want to be legal, and we don't want any problems. So I wonder, could you speak a little bit to that?
Chair Wilbur. Representative Edwards, I appreciate your vote of confidence there, but I'll assure you that the people in my staff are smarter than me when it comes to this. But there is confusion out there, mainly around this idea of legislative administrative interest. I think Mr. Johnson pointed it out, that there is a disconnect in the statutes. Now, this idea of only the decision makers being susceptible to the statutes, frankly, that scares me. I mean, I look back at my own career when I was very low on the rung at the Department of Revenue as a revenue agent, but I still had a lot of decision-making authority. Do I garnish you? Do I put you in the back of my files? Do I charge off some of your tax? I mean, there's a lot of decision making made at a lot of levels of state government. But we do, what we try to do at our offices, especially around more difficult questions, is we do try to get together and discuss that. And there are times that we bring in our legal counsel to see if we're going in the right direction. You know, there's many questions we can answer very quickly for folks, but there are many, out of those 600, there are some very challenging questions. But I just want to point out for the committee, if one of my staff gives you a written advice, that this agency will honor that. It does not have to come underneath my signature. So, but you can rest assured that I have been informed of that. That's another nice thing about being a small agency. I'm not far away from the employees.
Follow up.
And just a quick follow up to that, though, because these are gotcha issues in a political environment, while some of us may have faith in a staff opinion, I think that an opinion that comes from the director of the Ethics Commission carries more weight on the front page of the newspaper. That's just an observation.
Chair Roblin, Representative, if I discourage you in any way of asking for that, I didn't mean to do that.
No, I don't feel discouraged, and I'll continue if I have any questions to ask.
Representative Greg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, Ron, I think your agency deserves a lot of credit and a lot of thank yous for what you've gone through in the past year. This is in regard, my question is in regard to the quarterly reports. I know the last three that I filed were all blank because I'm so scared of doing anything. You know, I just stay away from the lobbyist and it's blank. All I do is sign it. When I mail that in to you, what happens to it? How does your staff handle that blank report?
Chair Roblin, Representative Girard, I talked a little bit about that. Again, this is a paper system, and so the mail comes in, we open the envelope, we sort that through. It eventually ends up getting filed with your statement of economic interest. So if somebody does have a public records request for your statement of economic interest, okay, they will also get your quarter reports. And just for the record, my last four quarter reports have all held 02. So I didn't mention that in the report, but the vast majority of quarterly reports do not have zeros reported on them, or they do have zeros reported on them.
Can I have a follow,
yes,
Mr. Chair? Is there a way to eliminate the quarterly reports for some and still require for others? Because it sounds like you need it from, like lobbyists, much more than you need it from perhaps legislators.
Chair Roblin, Representative Jarrett, I just want to clear something up. Lobbyists, they file a lobbyist quarterly report, but they are not required to file the public official quarterly report.
Okay.
Those are two separate. But the two should match. In other words, if a lobbyist had reported that they had given you something that met one of the criteria on the report, then we should be able to look at your report and see that you actually put that down. But is there a way of shoring this up? Sure. You know, there is a way of doing that. I think that's one of the challenges that we all face this session in trying to kind of shore up some of these problems that we see. Like I say, I call them challenges, but, you know, I mean, yeah. I think there is, yes.
Mr. Chair, I hope when we get into the meat of this thing and actually start talking about it, that Mr. Burson will be back with us too.
I anticipate having the involvement of Mr. Burson all the way along.
Thank you.
I value his work and I value his expertise. He knows better than the rest of us what's going on here with respect to the procedurals and the processes that we're going through. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me with a few comments, because
sure,
the hour's late, and what some of you might not understand is that Ron Burson walked into this thing just as the Law Commission was finishing its, and just before the legislature started last session. He didn't have a whole lot to do with the development of the Law Commission, and he was left with the implementation of what we came through without any testimony and went flying through here, and then got duck soup when he walked in to try and... So, really, in defense of what he walked into with a new job, it's astronomical. I will also tell you that I am... have before me a legislative draft to change a lot of the things that we're talking about here. I am working with Representative Judy Stigler, who you may or may not know was chair of the Ethics Commission. So she has a pretty good working knowledge of how this whole thing works. We are hopefully going to come up with a joint draft of suggested changes. The Senate has their things. We're doing ours. I met with Ron yesterday for a while. I'll meet with him again and again and again as long as it takes to get this done, because at the end of the day, I'll say this in public to Ron, we have an awful lot of things to fund in this state that are a lot more important than paper shufflers in his shop. And what I want to come out with is something that he can easily explain and easily implement without a huge, you know, burden on anybody, least of all him, because I don't think we want to be funding paper shufflers. No offense. So at this point, I have a draft. It addresses some of these things. It's a work in progress. I would love to hear from all of you at any time in the next week before Judy and I finalize this thing on what you want to do here. And believe me, I'm going to have Ron there to go over it too.
And thank you for that. And I'll also say that we will have hearings on these when the drafts come and bring people here and get some input, because I think we do the best work here when we hear from the most people. And I really look forward to that in this session. I am one of those people who believes that what we did last session was the right course. We had 30-some years, 40 years of adding on to something that had gotten to the point where it didn't make sense in places. It was contradictory. It heightened everybody's understandings, and we now need to move forward to make it better, and that's what this is about. Other questions or comments? Seeing none. Thank you very much, and we will have you back. And with that, we will adjourn the Committee on Rules. Thank you very much.